Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. That pause that I had there was like, I wanted to say broadcasting live, Bezrat Hashem, with the help of God from Jerusalem, and trying to really weave in God into your thinking, into whatever you do. And I'm joined here with Rabbi Mike Foer. Rabbi Mike, shalom and welcome.
Shalom, Yishai. It's good to see you.
You know, Rabbi Mike, I read something in Rabbi Nachman that I like very much. He says, before you walk into a store, you got a wallet full of money. You're about to walk into a store to buy that thing that you really wanted. He's like, look up to God and say, God, will you please buy me this thing? Will you please buy me this thing? And same thing, Rabbi Zusha, you know, famously, he would say, like, Zusha is hungry. God, yeah. Zusha is hungry. And just little things like that. And I just think it's an important thing that we do as Jews. You teach that to the kids. Like when, you know, we start a new page we're writing, we add a B'siyata D'Shmaya. That little thing, like a little BSD, which, you know, stands for with the help of God. Little things like that to inject, weave in.
Well, you want God to be the frame of reference, I think, and also an intimate relationship, but both, meaning God should always be like right there next to you, but also the context of everything that you do. That's the key to a deep relationship, I would say.
Great. Well, that's going to be a great intro to our show today, and I'm excited. We're going to do the Torah portion of Parshat Vayera in the book of Genesis. We got a lot of moral quandaries to deal with, and that is the framing of the show. The framing of the show that I want to do is I want to go through every story, pick out one problem.
One quandary?
One moral or ethical, because sometimes they're a little bit more. What's the difference between moral and ethical, by the way? Is there a...
I don't know if we want to go there right now.
But ethical, let's put it, is a more, you know, moral is like a deeper thing. Ethical is like more of a, like...
My understanding is that ethical is a kind of philosophical, systematic perspective, and moral is the sort of behavioral action perspective.
Okay, so we're going to deal really whatever the categories are. Maybe there are three. They're religious, they're ethical, they're moral. But every one of these stories that we're going to deal with, and I thought to myself, this is the Torah portion where every story, and it's got these like four or five stories. Every story is like, you're made to feel uncomfortable. Now, some of your students here at Pardes would I think misinterpret that and be like, this is a problematic text. Instead of understanding that...
The whole point of it was that it should trouble you. Right, yes, I've had this discussion specifically about the binding of Isaac many times.
Right, it's laid out to be scrutinized. It should
trouble you. Meaning
trouble, right.
The idea of a moral quandary is that there's no simple answer. If it was a simple answer, it wouldn't be a quandary.
Right.
It would be a question.
But do they realize, sometimes they don't realize, that it's written in such a fashion purposefully?
Yes.
It's not like... Oh, look at you. You're in the year 2019. And
now this troubles you, but everyone up till now has found it perfectly clear that he was going to sacrifice his son. No, yeah,
right.
It's true what you're saying.
Right. And the truth is we're going to have a moral problem or a quandary in every one of the little stories. I really I was like, wait a minute. Every story's got a little issue here that you don't feel quite comfortable with.
So throw your best quandary at me, man.
I will. But before I go on to that, I just want to say something before I forget it. I wanted to tell you a phrase right before the show. I decided to leave it for during the show. Here's what I wanted to say. First thing, we're on the Land of Israel Network, an awesome network with great shows, and God bless all the other broadcasters, including your
Amen.
Great show, which is called The Jewish Story, which is found here on this network, and a lot of fun. There's a lot of good stuff here. My sister, Dr. Racheli, she's a you know a you know, a PhD from Columbia, and now she's at the Weizmann in chemistry, organic chemistry. In any case, she was at a reward ceremony just now, and one of the Israeli, very famous Israeli anchors was speaking. It's one of the little gigs you get. You like speak at all kinds of events,
awards or whatever.
Right. This was an award ceremony, and who it was? It was actually an acquaintance of mine, Dana Weiss. Now, Dana Weiss is a very famous Israeli Saturday night anchor, not just of news, but of a news show, like a 60 Minutes type thing, an investigative show. She's very well known and respected. Now, she happens to be on the left, maybe even further on the left. I mean, I wouldn't call her the far left, but further down the road.
Further left, not far left.
Right. So she said something that at the speech that my sister told me that I wanted to tell you, which is, she goes, if you want to just, in one question, understand where somebody is politically in Israel, just ask him the following question. Is time working for us or is time working against us?
Interesting.
Right? Like,
so therefore the right is going to say time is working for us.
A person like me, immediately I was like, of course time is working for
right.
us.
Right, time's on our side.
That's my whole outlook
and,
is.
And the left feels like things are slipping time, out from under us. We got to make this deal now because there's ticking bombs and the demographics. And
look at the whole outlook. It's like time is against us. We're in a kind of
trouble. It's a pessimistic outlook.
Right.
That's interesting.
Right. And I was like, wow, that is just a good one. Is time working for us or is it working against
us? What's interesting, most interesting to me is I hear that also as a secular left-wing dodge of the God bullet, meaning you could also just put the word God in there.
Say it.
Is God working for us or is God working against us?
That's good.
Because I think that in the end of the day, time is a euphemism there. Time doesn't work. Time doesn't work. It doesn't work for anyone. Time just is. Right? When you say it's time working for us, there's an implication of will and there's some sort of like driving force.
Right.
I think what you're hearing there is an inability to articulate the sense that there's a larger will which is pushing against or pushing
just
forward.
Just this morning to relax, I watched World War II in color on Netflix.
I always find Normandy to be quite relaxing.
It was actually Pearl Harbor.
Okay,
and
even more so.
What a complex and interesting story. How interesting it was. How many things had to fall into place. For example, the planner, the major planner of the Pearl Harbor attack was a guy who was actually against attacking the United States. But if he's like, but if we're going to do it this way. Let's do it right. And it was very Japanese. It was. You know, the whole thing was 2 hours. 2,000 soldiers, sailors were killed. Very intense. But like, the whole time I was thinking to myself, wow. And please do not misunderstand that I'm in any way making light of the sacrifice of those people. But I thought to myself, wow, what Hashem did in order to bring the Americans into the war so that they can defeat the Nazis so that Israel could be born.
Well, I mean, by the way, it's not just God there. There's a lot of theories that Roosevelt knew that something was coming and not obviously of the scale that what emerged, and the only way to get the American people into the war would be for them to suffer some sort of attack.
They talked about that. They talked about that he was goading the Germans or the Japanese to attack, but they didn't expect Pearl Harbor.
No,
they thought
of course
Philippines.
Not.
Yeah. They thought other places.
Well, this is one of the great challenges of democracy in general. We're facing it right now with the nonsense once again going on with Gaza, which is that democracies have a challenge in marshaling the social will to get people to sacrifice their short-term interests in favor of their long. And so that's why we keep ending up in these sort of like spark, flash in the pan rounds and round six with Gaza, right? Because why? Because to actually marshal the social will for us to send our brothers, sons, fathers, friends into what is going to be a bloody and prolonged conflict with some visual outcome is extremely difficult.
And so on Pearl Harbor, they kept saying, well, the Japanese or the Americans knew that the war was inevitable, inevitable.
Right.
And bringing that back to the time element, which is like, It's fatalistic a little bit. It's like their war is the gears are turning. It's happening. It's going that way.
Notice people have begun to speak the same way about war in our region again between us and Iran, or you know the Gaza
quagmire.
Inevitable quagmire. What, like you know, it doesn't have to be a quagmire.
I do want to say that yesterday I was at home. I was out, and then I came home and my kids were curious and a shtickle scared.
Yeah, mine were also a little bit
shtickle scared. And my son, Elazar, who's 8, says, let's watch the news. Now, I had recently purchased this machine that lets me have like 5 Israeli TV channels in an old school way through an antenna.
Really?
But it's not a regular, it's a digital antenna, but it ain't no cable. It's like the basic Israeli shows. But the real strength of that package is 8 p.m. news. That's really, the rest is weak. But my son says, let's watch news. I said, good idea. And we all sat down for 30 minutes. We watched from around the country what was going on. Well, my kids were like, they left it a little bit even more scared on the one hand. But on the other hand, there was a lot of Jews, Israelis, who were like, yeah, my house was bombed, but we're all right, thank Hashem. And there was a lot of also Jewish strength that you saw through there.
So, I mean, listen, the people living in the Gaza border have a strength at this point, which is unfathomable.
Right.
It deserves to be responded to on the part of our larger society and our government. I understand in part why we haven't yet, but the time, it's going to come sooner rather than
later. Inevitable. It's inevitable.
Yeah, it's coming.
Yeah.
I would rather we chose it than just waited for it to happen.
Well, and we kind of did choose it yesterday by taking out.
Poking the bear.
Poking the bear.
That's what you call that. Poking the bear. It's totally poking the bear. It's like, what is he going to do now?
Can I call the show Poking the Jihad Bear?
If you want.
Jihad Bear.
Only if you quote me on that.
Okay, Poking the Jihad Bear. Okay, fine.
Yeah, and I did notice your tweet about the fact that at least they're not subtle when they call themselves Islamic Jihad.
I like that. I like that. They don't call themselves the Party of God or this and that. It's like, look.
No. This is what we're about.
We self-define as Islamic Jihad, and that's okay. You know what I mean?
We sent out. We know where you stand.
And people appreciated that tweet because they just like, just look, it's a conflict between them. Anyway, we could talk about Twitter and what's going out there a lot, but let's get to the Torah portion.
Let's
have a quandary. The first part of the Torah portion is really Abraham is sitting in his tent. Our sages explain to us that's actually he's on the third day after his circumcision,
which is meant to be the most painful day.
Most painful day. It's a hot day, and he sees these. He's schwitzing, and it's the desert. And when I say hot, picture that yellow ball scene in the movies, like desert, like you.
And it says that God actually made it, took the sun out of its sheath,
right,
in order that Avram, who was so enamored of hosting and welcome guests, nor that nobody would be out, so he maybe would lay down. But no, instead he sat in the gate of his or door of his tent, just desperately waiting for somebody to
desperately
show.
To do that, desperately to teach, desperately to be to do Kiddush Hashem. Anyway, God sends these three people who are really angels. And there's a great interplay between people, angels, because there's a lot of food preparation happening here. Sometimes you really have to wonder, like, why the Torah portion goes out of its way to tell you, like, what was exactly the food preparation. And the rabbis explain everything. He goes to the son and he says, prepare the bullocks, and that's to teach him, you know.
Well, you know, you serve them. Tongue with mustard.
It's
like, who knew the angels were Ashkenazi?
That's right.
Rashi, I would not have guessed that.
I actually love tongue. And I like to eat tongue, and I feel a person like myself who uses his mouth a lot, you know, has to do that tikkun eat. But my wife does not like tongue at all. I do like tongue.
Just with mustard.
With mustard. Right. And okay, but here we go. And the basic message of this part of the story is, Abraham, where's Sarah? She's in the tent. Cool. Guess what? You guys are going to have a son. That's the upshot of it. You're going to have a son. And that's surprising news, given that they are, and the Torah tells us, Sarah's stopped having the menstrual cycle, the menstrual cycle. And moreover, Sarah says about her husband, he's old, i.e. he's old.
Right.
Okay.
I.e. we're friends.
I don't know. But here's the thing. So when Sarah hears this news, ostensibly good news, she laughs. And then there's a little tussle there where God says to her, why'd you laugh?
I didn't laugh.
She goes, you did.
You did.
Okay. So, and I always thought to myself, here's the first moral quandary here. What's the biggie here? Why is it upsetting or why is it either, what is the, and the Torah does not hint to us exactly what the emotional makeup is. Is she in trouble for laughing? I'm not sure. The laughter is itself a part of the name of this child that's going to be born.
Right. I mean, remember, who, by the way,
is not a big laughy, it seems
no,
like.
He's,
right?
He's not such a funny guy.
Yeah.
Although he is mitzachik.
Right. He is mitzachik Rivka. That's right.
You know, but Avram also laughed. Let's not forget that. And the first time
iteration.
We had this announcement, right. And of course, our sages make a distinction between the nature of their laughter, which is what illuminates for us where the moral quandary is, which is that his laughter. Well, listen, put it this way. Why do you laugh? What makes you laugh? If I say to you, a horse walks into a bar, you're already smiling.
Yeah.
Why? Because a horse doesn't belong in a bar.
That's right.
Right. The heart of humor is the ability to juxtapose things which our normal frame of reference doesn't put together.
Right.
Right. And so what God is telling both Abraham and Sarah in separate incidents is that, yeah, you have a way of knowing the world where old people don't have children. I'm going to put those two things together, and what in your mind, and what is it going to produce? So one is the sort of liberating laughter of like, wow, the world is bigger than I ever knew.
Right.
But the other one is the cynical laughter, which is, no, I actually know how the world really is. And that's the distinction that our sages make between their laughter, that Avram's laughter is a laughter of wonder, like who knew that the world could be like that?
Right.
And that Sarah's laughter is the cynical laughter of an insistence that even though God is telling you that it's going to be that way?
Right.
No, I actually know.
Okay, but the cynicism that I encounter around the world isn't a laughy kind often. It's more...
Well, no.
It's darker.
The deepest cynicism is when you can laugh at someone's naivete.
Right, but...
Like, oh, you silly settler. You really think that you're going to survive in the face of a sea of Arabs?
I'm sure people have
laughed at you before.
Well, I actually use it the other way. I use it oftentimes. I go, silly jihad. You're silly, you know, if you think you're going to get rid of us. But
that's not cynicism.
Well, it's...
No, that's exactly not. That's Avraham's, which is like I get why you see the world that way,
right.
But the reality is I have a wider perspective.
You think Sarah got in trouble for this laughter?
I mean, listen, our sages definitely say that it was not a positive interaction between she and God.
Right. But on the other hand, if you read the text, it's like, I didn't laugh, but you did. It's not like... It seems even more, I would say, even a tad informal. It's a tad like God is having a conversation with Sarah, and he's like, you laughed. Why'd you laugh exactly? And she's like, no, I didn't. He's like,
well,
yeah,
listen,
you did.
At the risk of jumping to the end of the Parsha, this plays itself out at the Akedah, at the Binding of Isaac.
Right.
Because one of the ways of understanding the Binding of Isaac is that it is the natural follow-through to the two different types of laughter that occur with the announcement of Isaac's birth. Right? God says to Abraham, you're going to have a son. And Abraham laughs because suddenly a whole horizon of the world opens up for him that he never even contemplated. And just think of how liberating it is. Like when suddenly, like, you know, you think you know what's happening and things look dark and grim and narrow. I'm never going to have a child. Everything's in. Suddenly, boom, the horizon opens up.
Right. Yeah.
Like it's liberating, right?
Yes.
And yet there's a final test that Abraham has to pay,
right.
which is, do you appreciate how big what I showed you was? Because now I'm both going to tell you that Isaac is your future and to sacrifice him. And sorrow, our sages say, dies when she hears that,
right.
that it almost happened.
In a sense, what you're saying is Isaac is no laughing matter.
Well, he is a laughing matter of a very particular type.
Right. I'm just gonna say that maybe here is one of those moments where Jewish humor, even a little bit of a dark humor, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Like we're gonna come out of this Holocaust and build a state.
Yeah.
That's it's like, you know, and there's people who cannot deal with any Holocaust jokes, and then there are people, and I think it's a Jewish thing, to kind of throw a little dark humor out there, and it's a dark laughter. But
wait, I've ever told you before that through some of the interfaith dialogue work I've done, I discovered there's a whole category of suicide bomber jokes that Arabs tell each other.
No.
Yes. Like apparently the word for virgin and raisin is very close to each other. So like a series of jokes about how you go to heaven, you discover 72
raisins.
Yeah,
right.
72 raisins.
Right. How many? I mean, just yesterday I told the old
joke.
Or
how long the line is to get into Jerusalem, the checkpoint, you blow yourself up, you get there first. And like, I'm telling you, like, who would think? There's a human tendency right. in the grimmest of situations to reach for humor.
It's like that suicide bomber who goes up to Muslim heaven, and then like George Washington's hitting him, and Ben Franklin's hitting him. And Madison's hitting him, and he's like, what's going on here? Where's my 72 virgins? They're like, no, Virginians.
Oh.
Oldest joke in the book. Oldest joke in the book. Anyway, the moral quandary there a little bit is Sarah's laughter and what really it is, what happens there. Now, the
next quandary.
Right. Next part of the story is the famous... It's really the it's maybe you would agree that it's the sister story to the binding story, which is God's argument for Sodom and the Sodomites.
Yes.
Right? Trying to defend
Abraham's
them.
Argument.
What did I say?
You said God's argument.
Yeah,
for
yeah, yeah. Abraham's argument for Sodom. And so Abraham stands. I think the text goes out of its way to juggle both humility and at the same time real Jewish chutzpah.
Oh, yes.
To talk to God. And by the way, interesting, from my encounter with Muslims, they've basically led me to believe that in Islam, there's no idea of changing God's mind. Like, you're a peon. You're an ant. You are not supposed to challenge God. You're not supposed to really pray for stuff, for anything to happen. You're just supposed to accept the will of God.
It's a fatalist stance.
Right. Fatalist or maybe not even fatalist. Maybe it's just like, it's a lot of humility, really, if you think about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, sure.
But that's not the Jewish position, or at least that's certainly not the Abrahamic position.
Yeah, I can say it is in there, but the Abrahamic position is specifically not that.
Right. And here he goes arguing for Sodom. And basically, there's a great phrase. Oh, you know what? I wanted to read a pasuk from every quandary, and the one previous is chapter 18, book of Genesis, Bereshit Yudchet, pasuk Yudbet, verse 12. Vatitzchak Sarah bekirba, she laughed within herself, leemor, saying, Achare bloti haitali edna, shall I have softness of skin after I have become aged? Vadoni zaken, and my master. Is old.
And I would point out that there's a at least a drush in that she's bekirba, that her laughter remains within her boundaries.
Right.
And that's what makes it cynical.
Right.
right? As opposed to the laughter that opens you out to new horizons.
Mm-hmm. Or she laughed within herself, as in Isaac was in her.
Oh.
Right? The Yitzchak bekirba. Like, it's like Yitzchak is inside of her.
This is true.
Okay. Fine.
Next
so, yeah. so okay, fine. So one angel goes back to, this is a little bit more explanation of the sages. One angel goes back to the heavens, but two go down to destroy Sodom, and God lets him know. God lets Abraham know, because there's a beautiful verse that says, "Listen, I have to. I have known Abraham." Here's the verse, Yutet. 19. Ki dativ. I have known Abraham. Leman asher itzaved bana ved beito acharav. He's going to command his household and his children afterwards. Veshamru derech Hashem. They're going to keep the path of God. Lasot tzedakah u'mishpat, to do justice and judgment. Leman hivi Hashem al Avraham et asher diber alav, so that God will bring unto Abraham what He promised him and what He spoke of him, and then definitely He's going to tell him what's going down in Sodom. And you know what? It's like, of course, this is a kind of tongue-in-cheek, like, don't misunderstand me, but it's like God's like, oh, I'm going to tell you what's going on, and then suddenly I didn't expect you to now argue with me.
Or
right?
That actually, because you didn't read the beginning of that paragraph, where there's this strange rhetorical question, like, who's God speaking to when He says, am I going to
hide
from
Abraham?
Abraham what I'm doing? Right. Right, he's going to be this great nation, and all the world will be blessed through him. I would say that this is an opportunity for something which is within Abraham to be brought out, mm-hmm. right? Because in the end of the day, God knows where this is going.
Right,
the one who doesn't, the unknown quantity, is Abraham,
mm-hmm.
and we see this again and again in Abraham's life. And I think many of these moral quandaries are function exactly that way: is that they bring out the depth of human experience that Abraham represents.
Okay, so but for most people, this is maybe even a shocking thing. This is in some ways one of the more shocking stories, and certainly at this early stage of the Book of Genesis, the shock is, and the moral quandary is, how much are you supposed to argue with God? You supposed to argue with God?
Yeah.
Are you supposed to say phrases to him like, will the judge of the whole earth not do justice?
That's
like, you're given tochecha, you're given lip.
This, by the way, this is the first instance in the Torah of anyone disagreeing with God.
Right.
God says to Noach, I'm going to destroy the whole world, build an ark. Noach says, okay, how big?
Okay, right.
You know? And this brings out the depth of what Abraham represents in the world. Right. I would argue that this is one of, when it says, v'nivarchu bo kol goye haaretz, right, that all the nations of the world will be blessed through him, that one of the great blessings that Abraham brings to the world, which the Jewish people to this day maintain, whether it's in our humor or whether it's in our chutzpah or what have you, is the fact that what it is to be human and to be a servant of God, to be a true servant, is sometimes to disagree.
Right.
And the question is, of course, when and where?
Right.
Because that can get a little bit out of hand, as
and
we know.
And I think you've said this many times on other shows, which is to be partners with God in creation. Like, that's the big moment here.
Yeah. Well,
the big moment is that, Let's discuss this. Before you do something, let's discuss this. I want to be a partner with you.
And at the end of the last portion, when God gave the covenant to Abraham, he said to him, "Hitalech lefanai v'ayetamim."
Right.
Go before me and be whole. As opposed to Noach, who, Hitalech et Hashem.
Right.
We went with him. They were holding hands. Meaning there is a creation which lies ahead that Abraham is the only one who can unfold. And God has given over, to some degree, the path ahead to Abraham. So this is what we see coming out here. This is a real will. It's a human will.
So quandary number one, we dealt with the laughter of Sarah. The second quandary is arguing with God. Third quandary is very dramatic, and that is the two angels go down to Sodom. They meet Lot there. Now, Lot has some Abrahamic characteristics.
Yeah.
He invites them into the house. It's important for him to protect them and house them. He recognizes their importance. But then there's a divergence. The divergence is that he's in a very bad neighborhood. The townsfolks come to the door and they say, "Oh, you have guests? Let them out so that we may know them." But this isn't the good kind of knowing. Okay, this is the bad kind of knowing.
It's the biblical knowing.
No, but even within
it's biblical knowing in a bad kind of way.
They're actually, I think they're using that term a little bit cynically. It's like, there is a good knowing.
Yeah.
This is not that.
No.
This is a dark warping of that knowing.
But let's call it what it is. They're looking for rape.
They're looking for rape. And they do, by the way, interestingly enough, at first they don't say that, but then later they say to him, when he comes out and he says to them, my brothers, don't do this thing, they say, we'll do worse to you than we wanted to do to them, as in they're admitting that they wanted to do an evil.
Right.
They admit that.
And you know what makes them so angry? Is that they say, well, you've just come to live amongst us, and now you're going to judge us?
Now you're going to judge us. Right.
Nothing evokes the anger of people seeking license more than the perception that they're being judged.
That's right. That's right, and that's exactly in contrast with what Avram says to God. Like, are you not going to do justice?
He's judging God,
right?
And God's thinking, oh, awesome! I've been waiting 2,400 plus years for somebody to do that.
Wow, that's awesome! But they can't take that. Now here comes the moral quandary. Here's the moment where you're like, this is weird. As he says, you know, I got these two daughters. Why don't you take them? They haven't been with a man before. Why don't
take
you
them.
Take them and do what you got to do? What is that? Now and now juxtapose that to that these same two daughters will later on in the very same story will ply their father with alcohol, as to have relations with him at night, as to get impregnated so they can repopulate the world and end up basically giving birth to two nations who are going to be enemies of the Jewish people, and yet within from one of these nations is going to come Ruth, who's going to be the great-grandmother of King David.
Right.
But like, what was that moment? What was the moment of
here, take my daughters.
Yeah, what's that about?
I mean, on one level, I think it's bespeaks in a very deep and disturbing way the nature of the society within which this is happening, is that his daughters are property, but that these guests are sacred. And in fact, he actually says to these men riding outside his house, looking for the verse here. So, you know, he offers them the daughters, but he says, you know, Al tasu davar ki al kein ba'u betzel korati. Right? Don't do this. Why? Not because it's morally wrong, right, but because they've come under the shadow of my roof.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a sacred bond that exists as soon as Lot brings them into his house. And he lives in what we would call a patriarchal society in which his female children are property.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is an uncomfortable statement from the perspective of our society, but I think it's one that sort of accurately illuminates why this would be a logical, if not logical, at least a moral decision from his perspective, that the sacred value is hospitality,
mm-hmm,
right? And that these two girls are actually not in his eyes, but more than property.
As opposed to Abraham, who is very concerned with, and God, who's concerned with Sarah and her chastity, and all that.
This is indicative of a moral system gone awry.
Right, right.
This is not. And now notice, on one hand, he's
upholding. What's the relationship from the fact that the first part, which he offers them to these rapists, to them afterwards plying him, like, what's?
Yeah, that's a hard one to plumb, other than the sort of the trauma of that experience. Remember, they're in the house, and they're obviously old enough to know what's going on, since
sure,
they witnessed their conversation only a day or two later, right? And one could say is that once you sort of pull the stakes out from any moral guidance by treating these children as property, then they've lost any standard of moral behavior, and it would make sense to them to seduce their father in order to sort of repopulate the world that they think has been destroyed. Meaning the stone represents a place where all moral standards have been destroyed.
Warped, yeah.
And I think that plays itself out in what they think is a good decision. Remember, they're trying to do the right thing,
right,
when they get their father drunk.
Right.
And that itself makes it more disturbing.
On top of that, you know, when you end up in a cave, but suddenly there's a flask of wine.
Several, apparently.
Right. Like, what's that about? That's another little thing.
We
stem
in them.
Right. It's
just
like,
happened to be here.
Yeah.
Well, look, and a barrel of wine.
There's a few things like that in Torah where, like, you know, it's like a video game. Like, you just needed that weapon. You needed that thing. Like, dude, you know, there it is.
And as you pointed out, one of the things that comes from it is the line of the Messiah.
Right.
Which is a very rich vein to plumb in terms of the complexity of making your decisions in life, which on the surface of it, this appears clearly wrong. Right? And I'm not looking to justify it in any way. But how do we relate to a world in which wrong actions can give birth, literally,
right,
to the right results?
Right. That's another. That's a moral quandary. That's definitely a moral quandary. Okay. Next one is somewhat related, but this time back camera shift back to Abraham, back to Avraham Avinu, and this time he's hanging out in Gerar, which is basically Gaza.
Gerar,
right. It's important to know that Gerar is
Nahal Basul, which
it's a little bit
major
east
riverbed
of Gaza.
Yeah,
right,
that
a little bit
flows
east
into Gaza from the west. Right.
Okay, so he's there, and there's a king named Avimelech. He's got a nice name. My father is king, and Sarah is obviously. I thought to myself yesterday to see Sarah. Sometimes I like to think about things like that. Like, what Sarah really look like? You know, just you know. So
the answer is you wouldn't have known because she was too modest to show you.
Obviously, other people were able to adjudicate that she was quite beautiful, and Avimelech takes her in, and now this is the second time that we've learned of this taking of Sarah,
and the second time that it's premised.
On that she plays the sister.
That Avraham says she's my sister.
Right.
But, you know, like, fool me once, shame on me. Or shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. You know,
right.
It's like.
But that was, okay, the first one was Pharaoh. Here is Avimelech. An interesting relationship, again, between Egypt and Gaza there. But in any case, God comes to Avimelech at night. Now, Avimelech is going to twice in this Torah portion, like, he defends himself. His big defense, by the way, is ignorance.
So I didn't know.
And he'll say that later also. Yeah, you didn't tell me. Yeah. I didn't know. I started thinking the second time around, I'm like, methinks you
protest too much.
You're a little too ignorant.
Yeah.
You know, like this, the first time, I'm like, hey, maybe he really didn't know. The second time, I'm like, he plays this card a lot. he keeps saying that I didn't know. Maybe he kind of did know. In any case, God says to him, now it's interesting. He's also arguing with God. For himself in this case.
Yeah.
He says.
Avram's opened the door in our story.
Right. He says, listen, he told me she's the sister. And I didn't know. And I did it with a good
conscience.
Good conscience. So God says to him, by the way, this is not the tetragrammaton Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. It's the general Elohim. Right. And he says, well, I know that you did it with a good conscience, but I saved you from touching her or else. Right, like meaning to say, I actually did you a favor because I stopped you from touching her one way or the other, or else you would have gone down. Now, interesting. Here's another thing. He says, "Now return." Here's my moral quandary. Return the woman to the man, for he is a prophet. Vata. Now, this is chapter 20, verse 7. Ata, and now hashev eshetaish. Return the man's wife. Ki navihu. He's a prophet. V'itpalel badcha. He let him pray for you. V'chaye and live. V'imein chamashiv. But if you don't return it, da ki mot tamut. You should know you're going to die. Ata v'kol asher lecha. You and everything that's yours. Now, here's the interesting thing. And he does so. By the way, there's a funny. There's also some humor in this week's Torah portion. He says, check this out. He says,
here's your sister.
Here's your sister.
That's the best line. I was reading it this morning. I'm like, ooh. Oh, the sarcasm.
I caught that at 11. Here's your sister. All right. Yeah.
Jerk.
Here's your sister in quote marks. Here you go.
Jerk.
Right. Thanks
you
a lot.
Killed me.
But here's the moral quandary here. Why does it when God says to him, okay, return the thing and make sure he prays for you because he's a prophet. Wait a minute. I made a mistake. You agreed that it was
in innocence.
Innocence. And I'll return it. Why do I also need to coax this guy who's a prophet to pray to you who are talking to me now to get back to wholeness? Like, what do I, like, what is this, some kind of bureaucracy? Like, I got to go through the other guy. You got to go to this office, fill it out in triplicate, and come back here. Is that what it is? Or what's he saying? Oh, by the way, maybe it's something that I said before, which is there's two different energies or channels of God that we're talking about here. The God of nature, the God of all things, says, listen, you need some special.
Yeah, we're going to up level on this one.
Yeah, you got to go to Avraham, who's going to talk to Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, to the Tetragrammaton side of the story, and he you need some personal what's it called? Intervention here.
Yeah, I mean, I think. A lot of it revolves around the fact that this is the first appearance of the word Navi in the entire Torah, right? And it's the first place that we encounter that there's a special, like you said, office. I mean, you were joking about bureaucracy, but office or a special role, a human capacity for divine intimacy. And so it may be that that, yeah, of course, I mean, God could heal Avimelech without Avraham's intervention.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a situation here where God is able to elevate Avraham even through his questionable behavior in once again presenting Sarah as his wife. I mean, sorry, as his sister. Right? That we are introduced to the idea that Avraham has a special relationship with God. And that even someone like Avimelech, who's apparently merits a dream where he communicates with God, even that is not what Avraham's holding. And so therefore, God uses this as an opportunity to enhance the status of Avraham and to introduce to us as the readers down through the generations the fact that what a Navi is and the ability to act as intercessor, which is one of the primary roles that Navi plays for the rest of the Hebrew Bible, is something specific in particular, and it belongs to Avraham and his descendants.
Avraham is also going to benefit personally from this because, and this is an amazing teaching here, which is that when he prays for Avimelech and his household, it's Avraham who's going to be blessed.
And that's the other, I think, other answer, is that this principle that that when we truly want something, that actually praying for others to get that which we need is a way in which we can open that channel of the divine will into the world.
Right.
So basically, God's once again using this as an opportunity to benefit Avraham and not Avimelech.
Okay, I just want to turn this for a second into a very practical thing, advice for friends, listeners. By the way, I just want to say in parentheses, I got a lot of emails last week about Leah being on the show, a lot. I got a lot of people really like that. And I also have emails from the previous week about morning rituals.
Yeah, I got a couple too.
Let's get to that next week. Before I close this parenthesis, I'm flying out tonight to Florida for like 5 days, so I didn't have time to print out everything and look at everything. So we'll try to do it for next week. Those were great emails, both of the kinds, and we'll get to that. Close parenthesis. But the advice for friends is like this. Whatever problem you have, and you have a problem. I know you do.
Don't we all?
Identify it. Then... And speak it out or write it down, and then find a friend, colleague, person that you know who has a similar problem in your estimation. Don't say a darn thing to him or her, and just pray for that person. Just pray for that person for that thing without even saying, "And also God remember me within that." Just.
Well, I would say specifically without saying
right,
that.
Just focus on that person and do a kindness, which is to pray for that person's problem.
And part of the power there is it removes the small ego self from the power of prayer, right? Like our sages are always very worried about prayer as gimme, 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 right? Like I want more money, I want better health, I want to, whatever, a spouse, etc. I mean, those are legitimate desires, but do they really belong in the world? Does the world need more wealth through you? Does the world need more companionship through you? So the answer is, if you really want the world to be filled with more companionship, really, genuinely, of course, you also would like to be the vehicle, but really what you want is that God's will finds expression through love in the world. So prove it to me by praying for someone else instead of just yours.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you open that channel, then more of it will flow in the world.
Great. If you have any examples of that out there, any success in that, why don't you do hashtag pray for someone else? Pray for another. Hashtag pray for another, and give us a story about how that worked. If you want, I don't have to use your name or whatever it is, but pray for another. That's an awesome thing. Okay, so Abraham prays for Avimelech. Their household is, once again, it was somehow closed up. The channels were closed up, and so there was no birth. There was no, and I think there was also people were stopped up in all kinds of ways.
It's really strange that Rashi, like, insists, even though the simple reading is about birth, Rashi insists no constipation.
Right. They were stopped up. The whole thing was stopped up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nothing's moving.
Nothing's moving. But if you think about it, I understand what Rashi's saying, because when there's no flow, if you think about the human being, really flow through is absolutely key.
It's the only thing that allows us to receive more than our limited capacity.
Right.
Remember, that's the theme of
but it also to expel. Meaning to say also to get rid of waste.
Yeah, for sure. And then to make room for more. But the flow through is what I'm speaking about. And again, it brings us back to Yitzchak and that laughter. How do you hold more than you're capable? Or let's say it differently. How do you receive more than you're capable of holding?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So laughter is one answer.
Right.
And here, praying for other, meaning that flow through, that the divine will should flow through me. Not that I have my limited gimme, gimme, gimme attitude, right. But, you know, God, do your will through me mm-hmm. for another.
That's right. And remember, I say this to myself sometimes, I'm a channel for good. I got to be a channel for good. So if I'm angry and stuff like that, I'm not doing my job because I'm not being a channel for good.
Yep.
Right? That's not what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be a channel for positivity, for Ein Tova, not Ein Ra, etc. Okay, the next story is going to be a dual story. First is the birth of Isaac and his weaning. The great humorous, I think, great Yitzchak story is that the Medrash says that they had a weaning party at 2 years old. But all the wives of the ministers and stuff that came to the party brought their babies. Somehow all the wet nurses were off that day. It was some kind of strike, union thing.
Wet nurse strike.
But guess what? All the babies started crying. Wah, wah, wah. That's not a party.
It's like babies on the bus.
Babies on the bus go round and round. Wah. Right, wah, wah, wah. That's right. But guess what? Sarah
steps up to the plate,
is able to just feed all those kids. That she's able to nurse all of those kids, and I mean, to the point that she's the super
of
nanny
of antiquity,
right? I need to write that down. So
you know, that's my goal of a show, to get you to laugh and then write something down.
Well, you know, there you go. We're talking about Yitzchak, and she nurses them all, and I mean, to the point they're all just passed out. These kids are just digesting.
Yeah, I know that, like, googly baby, like, right, googly a drool coming right out there, and their eyes are, like, right, rolling
and
back.
They're all having Hebrew milk. You know what I mean? They're having Chalav Yisrael. They're all having Chalav Yisrael, and I think there's a message in there that Sarah teaches, you know, Torah to the world. By the way, the just on the parable level, check this out, they accuse Sarah of stealing this baby. There's no way that this old woman could have had this baby.
Right.
She must have found it in the marketplace.
Right.
She picked up this kid, and now she's faking us. But when she was able to feed everybody, it was obviously proof that her body was working,
right,
that she was indeed able to conceive and give birth. But the other part of the story is, you accuse me of theft, and instead I feed you. That's the Jewish kind of story here. You accuse Israel of stealing your land, but we're a light to the world. We want to give you. We want to bless you. And you're always saying that we're horrible and thieves and accusing us of all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
It's a whole list. But instead, like, what Sarah wants to do is really feed everybody. But the other part of the story, which is exact contradiction to that, is that she doesn't want to feed one person. She doesn't want to feed little Ishi.
Yeah.
Okay? She does not want to feed Ishmael. And she
says, there's a hard place in the heart there.
Right. And what happens is Sarah says to her husband Avraham, this kid's the Ben Ha'ama, the son of the maidservant.
Right.
Right, because the Torah told us earlier that she gave to him as a wife. But here, in her language, also in God's language, Lo Yirash Ben Ha'ama im Bnei Yitzchak, right? My son Yitzchak will not inherit together with this guy. Sages say, well, you know, he was also shooting at Isaac and troubling him, raising him.
Right, or maybe you bring Avodah Zarah into the house.
Right. So she says, in simple terms, kick him out. Moral quandary is the moral quandary of Abraham, who, it says very clearly, this was really bad in his eyes. This was his son, his first son. Now, the Sephardi Jews will always say, they'll say to me, "Did Avraham, whose son is Ishmael? Did Avraham have Ishmael?" I'll say, yes. They'll be like, no. I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, that's Avram. It's a different thing.
Guy, right.
It's a different guy, and it's also a different body. Because he was pre-Mila,
right?
So,
circumcision.
So, so it was a different dude in many ways. Okay, and she's not the wife; she's the maidservant. But kick him out of the household.
No,
that's
clear
harsh.
Shot that this is something that Avram does not want to do.
Right.
Even when God promised him that Yitzchak would be born, Avram's first response was "Lu yichyeh Yishmael lefanecha." Like, listen, I actually have a son now. Like, let him inherit. And God says, "Don't worry, he's going to be a great nation also." But the plan, so to speak, the covenant is going to go through Yitzchak. And
the folks here at Pardes, could they swallow?
No, this goes to the heart of one of the most difficult aspects. And listen, you know, we make fun of the oversensitivity here often, which is not undeserving, but
no,
wait,
let me qualify. The Torah is putting it as a moral quandary.
Yes.
Abraham has a moral quandary. So when I say the students here have that quandary, they're having the quandary of Abraham.
Well, but the question
that
is,
that's not mocked.
The question is, are we able to hold both sides of it? Because
the Torah is asking me to feel Abraham's pain. It's asking me to have a moral moment here.
No, I understand. But my point is that there's a limited capacity I experience amongst at least my students to hold both sides of the quandary, which is that they're in not just like a simplistic, well, God said so, therefore you got to do what God says. But this is one of the expressions of the fact that there is a particularist element in the divine mission given mm-hmm. to Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever we deem to be the logic, Yitzchak, not Ishmael, this one, not that one, we could get into that, maybe yes, maybe no. My point is that at the root, there's a tension between the universalist element, which is Avram has two sons, and he's the Av Hamon Goyim.
He's Goyim. He's right? Like, father of
everybody, everybody comes under the umbrella. At the same time, in order for that to happen, it has to be this guy and not that one.
Right.
That there's something very particular about what ultimately becomes the Jewish people.
Right.
And that, on some degree, will always be bound up with pain.
This mother of a lion, this lion cub of a mother, the lioness of a mother, that it's Sarah, and reminds us also of Bathsheba. Is that this week's Haftorah? I don't remember. Or is that a different Haftorah?
That's for Chai Sarah.
The inheritance?
Right?
Like, we got these women who are like, they are like, no.
This is the way it has to be.
This is the way it has to be.
Rivka does the same thing.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. In many ways, it's one of the themes. And by the way, to go to that Haftorah you're referring to, which I'll just give a Mavin Yavin, that's the moment in which the prophet steps into the role of the wife. Because you notice Bathsheba starts that conversation, but Natan ends it.
Right.
And from there on out, the relationship of who speaks truth to power mm-hmm. is put into the hands of the prophet in their mm-hmm. relationship to the king. But in the stories of Bereishit, we see that, well, it's a patriarchal society, meaning the husband has the power within society. But who's the one whose role is really to say, you're off here?
Mm-hmm.
It's his wife.
Right.
Right. And it's a very important clarifying factor.
And God is going – so God is the role of the prophet. God steps in to say what she said was right.
Yes. Because Abraham is not able to accept it.
Right. And God says – and this is to me an amazing piece of information, which God says – listen to her.
Yeah.
He doesn't say
listen to me.
Right. This is right.
Yeah.
It's like you think there's an adjudication between two peoples in a disagreement. God says this is right or this is right. No. He says, and this is the way I understand it, you missed it. She saw it with her fleshly eyes. She saw the right way.
And not only that, but let's not forget that the relationship between parents is bound up with the way in which a child grows up. So when God says listen to her, he's pointing out that what God really needs is for Avram and Sarah to be partners in raising Yitzchak. And God would actually be undermining that possibility if God said, listen, I know you don't want to accept it from her, but you'll accept it from me. Because then Avram walks away resentful to Sarah.
Right.
And God says, no.
Right.
Listen to her and appreciate, right. like you said, A, you missed it.
Right.
And B, appreciate the fact that she saw it.
Right.
You need to learn to listen there.
Right. And now we Jewish husbands always have to contend with this verse, Shema Bekolah. And every rabbi will tell you, Shema Bekolah, listen to her voice. And we're saddled with this. That's just the way it is. And that's okay. That's fine. That's the way it is in the Jewish world. Shema Bekolah.
By the way, I would point out it's the way it is in the human world, but just right. not overly simplistic. I'll tell you a quick story. I once had a friend who was having shalom bayit issues, problems in the home, as we say. He went to a rabbi, very traditional rabbi, who told him exactly that. Anything that happens in the house,
Shema Bekolah.
Shema Bekolah. You listen to the woman. Yeah. Anything that happens out of the house, that's your job. So he came to me knowing that I'm not the most traditionalist type of thinker. And he said, what do you think of that? Is it true? I said, it's absolutely true. The challenge is figuring out who's the husband and who's the wife in any given situation. Meaning, no, I'm being serious, is that there is an aspect of how we relate to the world, which is a feminine aspect. And there's an aspect of how we relate to the world, which is a masculine aspect. A lot of people, men are purely masculine, women are purely feminine, and Shalom al Yisrael. But a lot of the complications come when we are unable to accept the fact that, no, I actually have a feminine energy in me as well. Right. And that's what's expressing itself here. And so having to negotiate that is quite complex, but it doesn't make this any less true. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm pointing out, is that don't fall for the trap, anybody listening out there, of thinking, oh, that's, my gosh, that's like some ancient patriarchal nonsense. No, because it's easily translatable into the world in which we live now. So appreciate there's a divine masculine and a divine feminine, mm-hmm. which finds its expression
there's
in
also,
the world.
There's also societal... masculine, societal,
and
feminine.
And they're not the same, by the way. And that's part of the challenge, is that traditional Jewish femininity, the as expressed as the divine feminine, maps somewhat onto Western. But many of the places that there's, I'll give you one of the classic examples.
This is the best example right here.
Yeah.
The Shema B'Kolai. She says, get him out of here.
None of that, but like Western society only values that which happens outside of the house. That's why feminism, early feminism at least, was so bound up with women getting to do what men did.
Right.
Whereas traditionally our society just said, well, actually what really matters is how you raise your children, because that's your future. That's as valuable as it gets. Listen to Sarah. Not, remember, you said, don't listen to me, said God. Listen to her.
Right.
But that is deeply unvalued in our Western secular mm-hmm. society.
Right. But I think the Jewish world, really, if you go around the Jewish world, you see there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that. And I'm always pointing to the Tomb of the Fathers and Mothers. The Patriarch, the Machpelah itself, is a building that symbolizes mothers and fathers. To me, by the way, this was never said to me, and I've really harped on this about Hebron. I'm like, this is a place, not only of the simplistic equality, this is a place of partnership, this is a place of love, this is a place of togetherness, this is a place of building. And it was so 3,800 years ago, and it was so 2,000 years ago to this very day. That is the whole message of this building.
It's the foundation.
Right. Yep. It's the family. Now, right now we're having a branding discussion about Hebron. And
they call it Tomb of the Patriarchs.
Well, I already won that battle.
Yeah, that's not patriarchy. It's not getting anywhere.
No, I've already won that battle. I told them it doesn't matter in Hebrew or in English. We never say that. We always say Tomb of the Fathers and Mothers, Tombs of Patriarchs and Matriarchs, however you want to say it. And people have accepted that.
Yep.
And people have really accepted that.
It's just true.
It's true, but it's also good. It's good business. It just works.
For sure.
It just works, and it's just you're getting more customers, and no men are like put off by that, and it's just good.
It's simple.
Right now we're actually debating calling it either Hebron, ancient capital of Israel.
Ooh, Jerusalem, getting edgy.
But as a prelude to Jerusalem,
I understand where it's coming from. People get edgy about capitals.
Well, it works in places like Kyoto and other places around the world where you have like an ancient capital, so people go see the ancient capital.
Right, I hear that. Interesting.
And it links it up with the rest of the country, and you know, and there's a lot of stories to be told.
Yeah,
you're right. I was pushing for, and I may be bending actually, but I wanted the first family of Israel, Hebron, the first family of Israel. But they may be right. Maybe ancient capital of Israel is good. But in any case, that was one of the ways that they came out. Anyway, Sarah says what she says. Then you have a whole story. We got two more moral quandaries. Let's get through it. Okay, we have about, let's do it in eight, ten minutes. Yeah, let's quandar forward, which is, it's a quandar leap.
Oh.
I've been watching stuff about quantum computers.
Yeah, they made a recent big breakthrough lately.
Yeah, and just the whole, you know,
where
superposition
and how entanglement,
right? And if you look at something, then it stops working. If you see it, it's like
Schrodinger's cat.
What? I don't know what that is.
We can talk about it later.
Okay, so it's interesting. Quantum computer. That's it's like a leap forward is like
we're right on the edge of it.
Right, like. You know,
computing has already gotten back to the original mode of science, which is we don't know why this works. All we can do is describe the phenomenon that we observe.
Right, which is healthy for people. That's good.
It's humbling.
Yeah, it's humbling. That's good.
I just worry that one day we're going to wake up, the computers are going to be in charge.
Yeah, there is a concern about that. There is a concern about that. Or how much is it going to be us versus the machine? It's becoming a semi-reality. Like, I could see a chip being implanted in a brain soon enough. Like, why should I dial?
They're already playing with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, why should I dial the phone? That's dumb.
They're already playing with it.
Why should I look at a screen where I could look it through my eyeball?
Yeah.
Like, okay. But anyway, we can talk about it a different time. We'll find a Torah portion that's good for that. Let's go the exact opposite way, which is, okay, so Sarah's position was accepted. But that actually, there's a fallout, and that fallout is for Ishmael and for Hagar. The Torah spends quite two big chapters talking about Hagar and Ishmael. And this one, this is the second one, where she's sent away and she kind of fails in navigation. Somehow she gets lost in the Beer Sheva desert.
Or she was sent out to die.
I don't believe that.
I mean, where are you sending someone when you're in the middle of the desert? Just kicking around.
There's a spice root. There's a spice root there.
Okay.
It says vatetat. Like she messed it up. In fact, like, please don't misquote me. It's like, hey, aren't you like an Egyptian Arab lady? Like, aren't you like, aren't you good at this stuff?
Going.
Right. You're good
right.
at this kind of stuff. And if you know Bedouins, they really are good at this stuff. And for example, Israeli army uses them as trackers. I've worked with her many times. But in any case, she – and then also she runs out of water. So then you're already twice. You're like, you're failing. And then thirdly, she puts her son at a distance from her as to not see him dry out and die. And your senses, as a moral person, you're like, there's something wrong here. Like, I get it that it's painful to see the kid die, but don't you want to be with him
nearby,
to the
give
him whatever comfort.
End, yeah.
It's like you abandon him. When I read the text, it signals to me like
something's off.
Think about this. Judge this issue. What do you think about that? Is there something about Ishmael's parenting? Is there something about the way that they see the world that is affected through this?
I it's hard for me to say. I'm always wary of generalizing from this story. Also, the role it plays in my mind is so deeply bound up with Rosh Hashanah,
right?
And the aspect of judgment of God's intervention. I mean, it's a phenomenal story that God intervenes to save his life on the basis of the fact that God hears his cry.
Right.
That's what his name is.
Right.
And that in many ways that cry is going to come back to haunt us for
right.
Most of our history.
Right. The name Yishmael, which means God will hear, is a beautiful name. We even had a big rabbi with a very famous quote.
For sure.
About Rabbi Ishmael and how God will overcome his anger on us. Very famous rabbi. Was he the high priest?
Rabbi Ishmael, Kohen
Gadol. Yeah, he was high priest. So very famous rabbi. I like the name Ishmael a lot.
Yeah.
But the Pirkei the Rabbi Eliezer is like, God will hear at the end of time the trouble that Ishmael makes. It's like there's another side. And if you think about, by the way, Ishmael, one of their big things, I know when I bring people to Hebron, like yesterday I brought an important person to Hebron, the muazzin went off and he was just like, I don't even hear it. You know what I mean? It's like part of my.
Yeah, you just plug it in. Yeah.
I think to myself, it's mincha time, it's lunch time, I don't know, whatever. Yeah. But like, it doesn't even bother me. In fact, to me, it's almost like a smell of Chinatown. It's like it's part of my audio cuisine. You know?
Yeah, I understand.
But like for him, he was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And there's a purpose in that is meant to.
Asserts. Yeah. It is
and it's
an assertion
audio.
Of. Yeah.
It's Ishmael.
Yeah, no, I understand. It is a verbal or at least auditory assertion of a frame.
Right. Okay, so we don't have a great sense of that business.
I feel a dilemma. Hard for me to speak to it.
Right. No, I agree with you. I also don't have.
Although I would just emphasize that our tradition saw fit to stick this as the Torah reading for the first day of Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah,
there's
I
obviously
always wondered
something
about that.
Very profound in there.
Yeah. I was on the Temple Mount hearing a guy, read this out loud.
It's not the prettiest story of Jewish history.
No.
You wouldn't think that would be the one you'd bring up on a day of judgment.
Right. It's like, okay, so they send out, you'd think, okay, we're going to send you out. Here's a great compensation package.
Right.
And
golden parachute.
Yeah, it's all good. It's all good.
Small bottle of water and a bad map.
Oh, man. That is a quandary. Okay, great. Next,
ultimate quandary.
Right. Very quickly, though, there is one more little story here, which
micro
is about
quandary.
I don't know what the quandary is, but here is the city that's the star of this all this Torah portion is Be'er Sheva.
Yes.
Okay, we've been around Be'er Sheva, the desert of Be'er Sheva. We've been around Be'er Sheva, by the way, which is having a great renaissance right now. And Be'er Sheva is sworn. Be'er Sheva comes either from seven sheep or the oath, either Sheva sheep or Shvuah oath between.
Or an oath sworn on Sheva sheep.
On Sheva sheep, that's right. Okay, and Be'er Sheva will be later renamed. Abraham is going to plant a tamarix tree. It's called an eshel, and this eshel tree, if you find it today, if you look it up, you'll see the tamarix tree releases tiny beads of water, and it's like a 2 degrees cooler underneath the tamarix tree.
It's a microclimate.
It's a microclimate, and that means that people can sit there relatively comfortably. And the word vayita appears twice in the Torah, I think, as I saw it in the Baal Turim last week, which is that Noach planted this vineyard. And Avram planted, and both of these plants, the original plants, were from Gan Eden, says the Baal term. In any case, the last one is, as you said, the ultimate quandary, and that is the quandary of the binding of the Akedah. And we've already learned that God says, you know, your Ishmael's not going to inherit, but it's going to be through Yitzchak. And yet God says to Abraham, go to the place. And now the new star of this show is going to be Jerusalem, or the Mount Moriah, which is the heart of the, where the temple is going to be. Go back to this place and take up your son Isaac and offer him up. And offer him up. I heard one great answer here, which I will never forget, and it is from the exilarch of our time.
Rabbi John.
That's right.
I saw it coming.
I really see him as the Reish Galusa. He is the head of the exile. And I was therefore not surprised when he decided not to move to Israel. Now, he is a brilliant and huge person in our time.
For sure.
Really, and he's Marbitz Torah. He's Marbitz Torah. With his awesome yellow ties, he's Marbitz Torah, and he's an incredible person. And he said something. He was arguing with, I think it was Sam Harris or somebody else, one of these great atheist theologians.
You love saying that.
It's just funny. So
see, made you laugh. Atheist theologian. Those two don't belong together.
That's right. That's right. So basically, I think it was Sam Harris says to him, or somebody else says to him, "What kind of God is this that asks Abraham to sacrifice his son on the altar to some kind of idolatrous business?" So Rabbi Sacks says, it's exactly the opposite. This whole story was to show, he's like, in that time, everybody, any decent God would ask you for child sacrifice.
Right.
He's like, this whole story was to be like, and we're done with that. That's not the way to serve it. So the whole story is to say, don't do that. That was Sacks's take on that.
And there's a very powerful and clear way to see that in the text, which I think we've spoken about before, which is that name Elohim, the world God, the general term for God, is the voice which speaks to Abraham and tells him to bring Yitzchak to sacrifice him. But when God says, don't touch your son, don't make any wound, it's the Shema Vaya.
Right.
That there's a different revelation that occurs
right.
through Abraham's ability to hold what looks like mutually opposing ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Yitzchak's your future, now sacrifice him.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get the message I gave you when you laughed originally that the world is not bounded by your understanding? Now we're going to double down on that. How deeply did you internalize? Or were you only able to hold it when it gave you what you wanted? And then as soon as you got what you wanted, it's all about gimme, 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 that narrow ego self. Let's see, Abraham, are you able to bring a new revelation of my name into the world
mm-hmm.
by holding two things which the human capacity cannot grasp? Then this is why it's the last test, and it's the
and why is he not arguing with him as in back in the Sodom story?
Because to argue with him in this case would be to bring the ego self in.
Right.
Remember,
because Sodom is somebody
Sodom,
else.
Not only somebody else, they're the opposite of Abraham. They're right. the anti-Abraham. Right. They right. represent everything opposed to him. So therefore, right. it's clearly not ego.
Right.
It's actually about God and justice. Here, how could he possibly separate his desire, his passionate desire to have a son, from the moral mm-hmm. assertion that this shouldn't happen? So therefore, he knowing that, he's unable to marshal that side of himself, and therefore is forced to grasp two mutually impossible truths, that Yitzchak is both the future and is the sacrifice. And in holding that, he's able to put his ego aside, and that's how the new revelation comes forward. Remember that it's the boundedness of our ego self that prevents revelation. We don't believe it's possible. We live in a world where we impose limits, and God is knocking on the door saying, let me in, Abraham. And this is the great revelation.
And one of the very physical manifestations of that is the shofar.
Yes.
Yesterday, I took a guy who's a Sam Harris listening, self-identified, Jewish, nationalistic, but atheist. And we took him to Hebron, and he was having a good time with, you know, Hebron. It's a mixed bag, you know. There's good, there's
complex,
bad, there's ugly.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
You know what I mean? Anyway, we went into the store. I needed to pick up something for my trip tonight, so I went into the Hebron, what's it called, souvenir shop.
Yeah.
There's a big souvenir shop, lots of silver stuff, wine, sidurim,
merchandise.
What does he gravitate towards? But this guy doesn't have a money problem. What does he gravitate towards? A shofar. And I said to him, let me help you pick it. I could see that he wanted one. And I know how to pick him a little bit because, you know, he doesn't know how to blow the shofar at all. He tried. It was like, Anyway, I picked up a shofar for him. And here's this Jew. I said to him, let's go film you in front of Marta Machpelah trying to blow this thing. So we go out and he's blowing the shofar next to Avraham Avinu. And he, you know, in his heart, he's really like, I'm an atheist. He really feels that he's strong about that.
Mm-hmm.
He believes in that. But there he's blowing the shofar breaking out of those boundaries, you know, breaking out of those boundaries, trying to blow that shofar in front of Abraham.
Listen, in my experience, a lot of that atheist posture, a lot of it, not all, a lot of it just comes from their rejection of a false God, because they were presented at some point with someone's very limited,
right,
usually agenda-driven,
right,
notion of God. And that's, right, actually what this whole story is about. God's basically saying to Avram, you don't know me.
Right.
You might get a little closer to me if you're able to listen and you're willing to sacrifice everything you know, but you don't know me.
Right.
And in Avram's ability to hold that, he brings a much greater revelation into the world.
And that's the shofar, a one-end constraint.
Yeah.
And friction, and yeah, the other side.
Well, mina meta karati, I called out from the narrow place, v'anani b'merchavya, and God answered me in the broad.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. Rabbi Mike Foyer joins us, Parshat Vayera, filled with moral quandaries. We try to touch every part of the story with dealing with it, and that doesn't mean we've answered them all.
That's the beauty of a quandary.
Right, we're struggling with them, and the beauty is the text wants you to struggle with them. Love that struggle. That's the name of our people. Like, struggle with moral things, struggle with God, and you can, and you will.
Yes.
You'll be successful when you do, when you actually struggle. Not when you win.
No.
But when you tackle it.
The growth is in the struggle, for
all
sure.
Right. Rabbi Mike Foyer, I want to wish you a Shabbat Shalom. I'm flying out tonight to Fort Lauderdale, and I'll be in Palm Beach for the restoration weekend of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I'm speaking there a little bit, and I'm excited for that, but I shall be back with the help of God next week to see you. I will be back Tuesday, so hopefully we'll be back on recording next Wednesday.
All right, Mr. Shalom, I look forward to it. Travel safe.
Folks, you can connect with Rabbi Mike Foyer at RavMike@thelandofisrael.com, JewishStory.co, and Facebook.com/RavMike.
And I got a webinar coming up, pre-Hanukkah. People are interested in talking about Hanukkah and how it reflects on the American Jewish and Israeli Jewish relationship. Send me an email.
Great.
Facebook. I'll let you know the details.
Great. Oh, you know what I thought to myself?
What's that?
It says he takes Avram outside to see the stars. It says Ko Yezarecha. I was like, Ko is Chanukah, Chanu Bechavhei. I'm like, Ko Yezarecha. The Maccabees are going to be your seed after you. All right, folks. Hopefully, we'll catch a little bit of Malka Fleischer next. In any case, stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. Lots of love from the Land of Israel and the Land of Israel Network. Blessings from the Land of Blessings. More great stuff is on the way. God bless you. Lots of love and shalom.
Shalom.
This week on Israel Uncensored with Josh Haston, an interview with Maurice Hirsch of Palestinian Media Watch.
The Palestinian Authority continues to transfer vast sums of money to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. No one knows exactly where that money goes, over and above the money that they spend every month paying salaries to terrorists or allowances to the families of their terrorists.
That's Israel Uncensored every Monday with Josh Haston on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
Shalom, everybody, and welcome back to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting this segment from Judea with our beloved Malka Fleischer. Malka, shalom, and welcome to the show.
Hey, Yishai. It's spicy out there.
It's spicy out there. It is spicy out there indeed. And we actually felt it on our own flesh, this rocketeering. Now, obviously, if we lived in a different part of the country, we'd feel it much more. But here, where we live in the mountains, where, you know, you could actually see from some parts of Judea here, you could see the Gaza Strip all the way down in the coastal plain, but the rockets don't reach us here. On the other hand,
quiet Judea.
Well, quiet in that sense, but we have, of course, rock throwing and other things that we face here with this homegrown jihad in some ways it's very, you know, you hear about anti-Semitism in other parts of the world, but you're like, here in Israel, we have inside of the Jewish state, we have this jihadism that's thriving, and that's very painful and powerful, I guess. But what I wanted to say is that you actually felt it on your own flesh, because your sister, her husband, and their kids were in Israel,
right,
for the bat mitzvah. And
I want to thank everyone, by the way, who either wrote in or told me personally that they enjoyed Leia on the show last week.
Yes.
She got a kick out of that, out of doing the show, and some people wrote in or contacted us and let us know that they enjoyed that.
Not just some people. Proud. Not just some people, but probably more emails that I've gotten on any particular show.
Oh, wow, really?
Must have gotten just a lot of email people.
Tell her. I don't know if you told her that.
I showed her some of the emails today.
Wow.
I read your emails to Leia just to show her how you guys felt about that. That was really neat.
Thanks, everybody.
You were supposed to go see your sister who was in Tel Aviv yesterday, and you didn't go
because there was video of like rockets exploding on the street. A lot of you have probably seen this video, which made it around, of these cars like driving down the highway, you know, rush hour, whatever they're doing, getting to work. And this rocket touches down like, I don't know, a foot behind these two cars. It was like an absolute miracle that the rocket did not hit the cars or make them explode, make their tires pop, make I don't know what. It was like an absolute miracle. But because of that, I was a little like wary to drive because even without all that, you know what I mean? If there's like a rocket siren and then I'm driving with three kids in the car and I have to pull over and unbuckling everybody and getting them on the ground, like it just seemed to me not the day to like go on a family outing. And my sister who was here with her family, this was her first rocket siren. They actually took it really well. I thought they even took it a little too well. Like they didn't seem very concerned about it, and they kind of like went to the beach and stuff. I'm like, guys, you guys should not go to the beach. Today's not the day. But everything pretty much worked out for them. But we couldn't hang out yesterday, and that was their last day.
I bumped into a guy who works in Tel Aviv here in Judea, and he says, I skipped going to work. I worked from home.
Right.
And he said to me, it just doesn't make sense to drive into the line of fire. That doesn't make sense. That's not the right thing to do.
You don't have to like get on the first plane out of here, but at the same time, like driving all around.
Right.
You got to just keep the roads clear.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm getting already emails and WhatsApps from people who are just very frustrated with the situation. The bad news is the situation isn't going away so quickly. It's just not going to go away so quickly. It's going to be it's going to continue this way because we did the horrible move of evicting ourselves from Gaza, from controlling
bad,
that.
Bad move.
And if we would ever do that again, God forbid, that's exactly what would happen. The Gaza Strip experiment proves to the average Israeli that this is an absurd idea to give away control of large tracts of land to the jihad.
Right. By the way, at the same time, it doesn't appear that we're ready to fix that mistake.
No.
And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and our new defense minister, Naftali Bennett, while they appear to be doing kind of what we always do, which is you know, strike targets and, you know, thank God we killed this new Palestinian Islamic Jihad leader. That's really, really great. And apparently we killed another guy in Syria like the same time.
I think they injured him badly.
Or injured him very badly. Anyway, that's also nice. So that's good work. But at the same time, like we sort of, you know, as of this recording, we've been hit or attempted to be hit by like 400 rockets. Do you understand what 400 rockets are? Now, thank the Lord, we have this new incredible technology which Hashem has bestowed upon us and put into the brains of the Jewish people to create, which is the Iron Dome missile defense system.
Mm-hmm.
This thing is like a game changer like no other. It has managed to make it that rockets don't hit stuff. It explodes them in the air, right? It sends our missiles after their missiles and neutralizes them in the air and stops them, right? Which has made it that Israel at war is not nearly as threatened as it used to be. But there's like a downside to that, which is that we kind of accept as fact the notion that we're going to get like rockets lobbed at us here and there. So like we got to, you know, just make sure they don't hurt anybody, right? And we haven't been able to do that all the way in this case, although the Iron Dome has certainly prevented numerous tens of disasters over the course of this period. There's still people who have been hurt. Just today, there was a woman in an old age home. The rocket like exploded outside the home or right in the home, and she got hurt by shrapnel and glass. And she's in moderate condition. The most heartbreaking injury was an 8-year-old girl who had a heart attack.
She had health issues previously.
I guess so. Yeah. The poor thing. Anyway, she's in serious condition, and businesses have been injured, and homes have been injured, and I've heard that it's, you know, the government, they reimburse for things like that. There's a certain kind of insurance that happens from the government with terror attacks, but it's not easy. It's not like the next day they're showing up on your door with like stacks of 200 shekel bills. It takes a long time, and not to mention the trauma and the cleanup. And let's say you lost things that are precious to you and you have to do interim plans. And if it's your business has been shut down for some time. There was like a toy factory in Sderot that suffered a direct hit. And then there was a fire.
Yep.
Right. So like those people, Sderot is not like a hotbed of industry. It's a small city in Israel. And I don't know what's going to happen to the business owner of this business. So we faced a hard couple of days, which weirdly weren't hard enough to cause us to do major, you know, stopping of terror in Gaza. We do this like low level stopping of terror in Gaza. We're not ready. We're certainly not like sending, you know, putting troops on the border and, you know, sending down flyers that we're taking back over Gaza in 24 hours. You know, you guys have like lost your, we decided that this unilateral gift that we give you, we're taking it back. We're not doing anything, you know, remotely like that. I saw an interview with IDF spokesperson Jonathan Conricus, who's like, well, we don't want this to become like a major thing. And I think to myself, like, IDF, like, is that you? Are you literally going public with the, like, you're there to like quiet everyone down and go, don't worry, it's not going to be that bad. I saw a tweet. I've been on Twitter a lot, as have a lot of us, over the last 48 hours. And I saw this, like, the IDF has been putting out a lot of tweets, which are getting shares and all kinds of stuff. So, but one tweet that I saw was like, civilians are not the target. The public is not the target. Buildings are not the target. Something like that. Like, terror is the target. And while I totally appreciate that, right? And it's true. Civilians are not the target and terrorism is the target. Like, shouldn't we be putting like the fear of God into the people who are on the other side of this thing? Shouldn't it be that the people of Gaza are like running into the streets and clawing the eyes out of the terrorists who are launching rockets from their neighborhoods going, you are not going to endanger us and our children. The Israelis are so flipping scary. You are getting out of here and like hitting them with brooms and getting them out of there. But instead the civilians are like, well, the IDF says they're not going to harm us. So we can just be calm. And like, this will play itself out eventually.
It's like those action movies where it's like, you're not going to hurt me. You're American police. You have laws. All kinds of stuff like that. It's
wait,
like,
where's that from?
It's whatever, Die Hard.
That
whatever.
Sounds like
it's
Die Hard.
You know, it's like, you're not going to hurt me. It's like,
and there's like, something very, very noble about that.
No,
it just seems out
ignoble.
Of place in this
right.
moment
it's
because it's like, it doesn't seem strategic at all. It seems like it's like the kind of thing that you say to the whole, like they're trying to say it to the whole entire world, because what they're more afraid of than rockets is that the world is going to be upset
yeah.
with us, which I don't like. Like, maybe I'm more afraid of rockets than I am of, well, you know, it feels to me like the people who are writing these tweets, like their families are maybe not in a bomb shelter. Like it feels to me a little impersonal, like,
yeah.
It feels to me like people who don't have empathy for the people.
It's not that they're not
Israel.
In bomb shelters, Muck. It's not that they're not in bomb shelters. It's that there's a milieu. A milieu, which means that, which is a general ideological atmosphere, which is not to be badass and not to be scary. And not, here's a crazy word that I saw about the Mossad in like a YouTube video from like the 80s. They're like, the Mossad. Ruthless, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, ruthless, that's a good word for a fighting machine. It's a good word. It's like, but we've been so indoctrinated with peace and the language of peace and the language of social justice and the language of humanitarian assistance, humanitarian rights, blah, blah, blah. All this language, which basically emasculates the maybe that's not the right word if you don't like that word, but I just mean to say generally it's against that kind of thing that you're talking about, which is in to boil it all down, it's defanging and it takes away the right to rage, right to rage,
and it really harms our deterrence
because
I think, on top
of course,
of everything,
because you don't have rage.
It's like, You just, you're like, you're really trying. You're like, don't, you're literally going out there and going, don't be afraid.
Right.
When really they should be afraid. Isn't, that's like almost one of the jobs is to be scary. If you're not scary, I don't get it. Like, I don't get it. It's just, it seems to me like we should be really making the enemy afraid.
Okay. Interesting segue here is that though you weren't able to go the day before to Tel Aviv to see your sister, you went today to see her in the airport via the super fast train from Jerusalem.
Super fast train. I went on the super fast train for
the
first
time. Shehecheyanu v'kimanu.
Yes. Oh, I didn't say Shehecheyanu. I didn't say it again. But it was really, really cool. And Shehecheyanu v'kimanu v'hegiyanu l'zman hazeh.
Right.
First of all, I want to, like, in parentheses, I thought it was like a little weird that Ben Gurion Airport is flying planes in and out with like no delays or anything. On the one hand, it felt good, and I was like, oh, that's nice that everything is, like, running as usual. But on the other hand, I was like, I hope this is going to work out okay.
Right.
That all these planes are flying in and out. I guess that's so, like, standardized by now. They know where to fly and where not to fly. I don't know how it works.
I don't feel comfortable with that either. And I happen to be flying out tonight.
Right.
So that's a bit, that's a bit
you always do that, though, Yishai. That's like a classic Yishai move. As soon as there's some kind of war or about to be a war
usually
a hurricane, that's when you're like, oh, I'm flying to America.
No. That is not the way it is. I'm usually in a flight outside of Israel, and then stuff happens.
Right.
That's what usually happens.
So this time you're just leaving me during the war. That's totally fine.
Bummer. I also want to say... Oh, Malki, you made me forget to say what I said.
Wait, but
oh.
I want to say about the fast train.
Yes.
I went on the fast train.
Yeah.
It was really, really cool.
Yeah.
It's really fast, and it got me from Jerusalem to Ben-Gurion International Airport in 20 minutes for 17 shekels each way. I feel like you can do that just to, like, eat at the food court and come back. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I could really use some, like, I don't know. They don't actually.
Bonbons.
Yeah. I really want some, like, airport air. I'm just gonna get on this thing really fast. It was nice, and I got to go over the big bridge right next to Jerusalem.
Right, not next to Jerusalem, next to Modin. Oh, that big bridge, the big bridge in the beginning. Oh,
yeah,
wow,
right,
that's cool.
Right, right as you're coming into Jerusalem.
Right.
The truth is, from the train, it doesn't look as big as it looked from the highway. Like I expected when they were building this giant bridge for a billion years,
it
was gonna be big and high. But the truth is, it's. It doesn't feel as high.
That's
as
because you didn't do what you're supposed to do when you ride, like rides. What do you call them?
What? Raise my hands up and yell.
Yeah, you got to be like, whoa!
I don't know that the other people on the train would.
Or as you would say, whoa, 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 whoa. Okay. It's a house.
That's
joke.
An inside thing. House anyway,
joke. Wait. I wanted to say something. This week's Torah portion, Malka, is also the Torah portion of doulas, and it's the one of the other Torah portions of women's Jewish birth.
Yes,
we got Yitzchak's birth, which is really no laughing matter, and also we got the weaning party. Yeah, we talked about it.
I don't know why Jews don't have this. I think it should become a tradition as a result of this.
Yeah,
why aren't there weaning parties?
Yeah, we have to have a weaning party.
I think I told you last year. I feel like I sat right in the same seat and said the same thing last year, but I'll say it again this year.
Our listeners love that feeling of cyclical repetitiveness that we do every year certain things. So please go ahead.
I just want to say that I totally understand what happened in the Parsha.
Yeah.
I think I said this last year. I feel it. But it's one of the like cuter things that happens in the Torah, so I like to talk about it, which is that it like goes by very quick. Like, oh, there was a weaning party and then all, you know, everything was fine. Here was what the weaning party was. The weaning party was Yitzchak didn't want to stop nursing. Did any of you have this kid? I had two of them, okay? Two kids, God bless them, Admevis.
The boys,
who did not want to stop nursing, particularly one of them who was a total fiend. And basically what Sarah and Abraham, like in Pig Latin in the back of the tent, they're like, we're gonna...
make a party.
We're gonna... Okay. You're going to stop, and then we're going to have a party for you. Oh, my God.
Wait, you mean you tell that to Yitzchak? You mean?
Yeah, they're like, Yitzchak, we got money for you. You get us to, and he's like, okay, and that was it. That was it. Sarah was like desperate, and she's like, you're inviting everybody, and we're having this flipping party, and Yitzchak is going to stop because enough already.
Right, I understand.
God bless him, little
very good
little lamb,
little Yitzchak, Baruch Hashem. All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. Malka Fleischer, thank you so much for joining me. I have to cut the show short because I got to get me to the airport, get me to the flight on time, and I'm excited for a short stay in Florida and meet a lot of important and good people who are fighting the fight for values and for strength. Against foes and against the narrative war. So I'm excited for a weekend in Palm Beach, but I am, of course, going to be spreading Eretz Yisrael, and I have with me 12 recessed maps. What are they called? 12
topographical.
Yeah, maps to give away to people, and I'm going to be bringing, of course, Eretz Yisrael with me and Hebron with me. I want you to come to Hebron and visit us by going to hebronfund.org. Learn more about what's going on in Hebron. Visit our Facebook page, which is Hebron Official, and of course, come on one of our amazing tours in English weekly with the amazing Rabbi Simcha Hachbaum. So come visit us in Hebron. Thank you very much. And also, put on some blue string by going to the True Blue Jew website, which is Tchelet, TEKHELET.com. Malka, I want to really bless you for a good time, an okay and relaxing time while I'm away.
Thank you, Amen.
Don't clean up too much or anything like that. Just chill.
Okay.
Just chill, relax.
If you insist, I will not clean up too much.
Yeah, just relax a little bit. I want you
bonbons.
To
bonbons.
Yeah, just bonbons and watch some TV and relax a little bit.
That's right. Fun.
I know that you a little bit relax when I'm away. I know that there's a truth there, which I don't what's the word? I don't begrudge you.
Thank you.
I don't begrudge you. Enjoy it. Wish me a lot of luck on my trip.
I wish you a lot of success.
And when I come back, Malka, it's going to be just a few days before Chaye Sara.
Oh, yeah.
The big Hebron party at Chaye Sara. 40,000 people come to take part in the reading of the Torah portion that speaks of the purchase of the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs by forefather Abraham. As an eternal resting place for the biblical family, the first family of Israel. So that's very exciting, amazing things. Please write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. If you want to write to Malka, write me an email, forward it to her, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. And follow Malka if you want a good hearty har strengthening and all the stuff. If you need, you know, you need laughing, you need strengthening, you need to cry, you need to laugh, follow her on Twitter. She is amazing. She's a Twitter master out there.
Wow, thanks,
yep,
Yishai.
You're doing great stuff. And that's it. I want to bless you from the land of blessings, from Judea, wherever you are out there. Whatever you need, may Hashem give it to you and bless you. And all Hashem asks you is that you stay connected to Him and stay connected to His great story, which is if you're listening to the end of the show, you are connected. So write me an email, #I'm connected. It's just that simple. I'm connected. That's exactly it. God bless you, folks, wherever you are. Shalom and Shabbat shalom.
Yes. Peace in the Middle East.
And shalom to home. Malka, thanks for being with me. Shabbat
yes.
Shalom.
Shabbat Slacha, Yishai. See you soon.
I have seen everything in the days of my vanity, says the wise of all kings. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man who lives long in his evil. Be not overly righteous, warned Solomon, and be not overly wise. Why should you bring desolation upon yourself? Well, I'm not worried that I'm overly righteous, and I certainly don't think I'm overly wise, but I am Rav Mike Foyer, and this is The Jewish Story.
Join Rav Mike Foyer for the best Jewish history podcast, The Jewish Story, on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.